It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I could drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Day number 26 of the Trump-McConnell shutdown. Getting worse. All the reports I'm seeing, families struggling, small businesses struggling, just chaos. And look, this is what I've been saying for a while. This is what Trump and the Republicans clearly want. It's what they clearly want and have wanted for quite some time. So not surprised where we are. I don't expect to see an end of this in sight. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. And this is, you know, one of those moments of this is an ideology on the right. And Republicans, if you're watching your chosen elected leaders, because these are the people that you put in there, if this is what you're okay with, then we're gonna suffer the consequences. Good day in the House, however, and this is one of those things I'm hoping the Democrats will seize this moment and start talking to working people and really start pushing issues that are going to make people's lives better. Today, the Raise the Wage Act was introduced. We're going to raise the minimum wage up to $15 an hour by 2024. And look, I remember back in 2012 when everyone said, oh, it's crazy, $15 an hour, crazy. And I remember going, well, you know, if you really value work, if you really are in that, you know, we need to reward work. If you're in that mindset, this is a start. This is a move in that direction. Now, obviously, I would have liked to have seen it gotten to $15 an hour faster, especially when we were talking about it back in 2012. In fact, you know, almost immediately we had people from New York and Chicago and fast food workers on, you know, talking about the plight of workers and, you know, the struggles that they had, not just in poverty wages, but in horrible working conditions and no voice on the job, being fired at will, or more likely what happened. They didn't fire anybody. They just stopped scheduling them. Oh, you're not fired. You still work here. You just don't have any hours. And that gets away. You know, then they don't have to, you know, really go and pay a minimum wage or pay unemployment. And I remember at the time telling people, go file for unemployment. As soon as they cut your wages, go file for it. And the more people that go and file for it, the more that they get punished for doing it. So the Raise the Wage Act, and we're going to talk a little bit about this with Mark Price, labor economist over at the Keystone Research Center. $15 an hour by 2024. Right now it is 7.25. Hasn't been raised since 2009. We're a decade into this here in Pennsylvania. Hasn't been raised since on the state level since 2006. The state minimum wage is still $7.15 an hour. But because it's below the federal is the floor. They are also going to phase out the tipped minimum wage, which, sit down and hold on for this one, hasn't been raised since like 1996. And that is a whopping $2.13 an hour. $2.13 an hour for the folks who bring you your meals and wait on you hand over fist. And, oh, by the way, laugh at your stupid jokes. I think it should be more than $2. I'm just kind of throwing that out there. Also, they're going to phase out the sub-minimum wage for people under 20 and those with disabilities. Again, it's another one of these moments where it's something that we should have done years ago. Hasn't happened yet. Also, they're going to index it to inflation so that we never have to go another 8, 9, 10 years without raising the minimum wage, without workers not falling behind. And it's not even a matter of lives getting better, you know, because you think, hey, I'm going to get a raise and, you know, I'm going to have more money in my pocket. It's going to make my life better. Sadly, in this day and age, most people are just marching in place and hoping not to fall too far behind. Because you read the headlines today, wages going up. And you go, wait a second. When adjusted for inflation, when you look at the cost of living and all that stuff, we're still stagnant. We're still deadlined. And for minimum wage workers, they've actually fallen backwards massively. Because when you don't have a raise in a decade, what do you think happens? Your buying power diminishes. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. Also, huge day in the Supreme Court. Who'd have thunk it? Who'd have thunk it that a unanimous decision? I know, stop, deep breath. Who would have actually thought that there could have been a unanimous decision in the Supreme Court and it actually helps workers? I was shocked as well. The case was filed by a guy named Dominic Olivier. He's a long-haul truck driver for a company called New Prime out of Missouri. I've seen them on the roads. Evidently, New Prime doesn't have any employees. They're all independent contractors. Now, they bring you in as you're going to be an employee, but then they do that bait and switch thing that, you know, I think all of these long-haul truck drivers, these carriers do. And now you're your own boss. You're an independent contractor, but you're going to, you know, drive our equipment, you know, be where we tell you to be, when we tell you to be, and we're going to monitor every move you make, and you're going to have to buy your fuel from us, and you just all of this stuff that when you go, but that's what an employee does. The Supreme Court ruled unanimously that in this case, these independent contractor long-haul truck drivers who have filed a class action lawsuit don't have to go through forced arbitration. That is a huge, huge thing. Not because this is a court that, you know, 5-4 majority loves forced arbitration. You know, the Concepcion case, the Rent-A-Center case. You go down the line of all of the cases that said, you know what, you're gonna sign it, and you're gonna sign away your rights. And in this case, what's interesting is that, you know, they've now gone the right way. And, you know, why is it? I don't actually, you know, legally, I'm not sure, because, you know, these folks, I guess it's because they're independent businesses is what they're trying to claim. Because I don't think this decision will filter down to employees. But as I was reading through the story, one thing jumped out at me. And they said there are about 3.5 million drivers in this country. That work for 1.5 million interstate carriers. Stop and think about that for a minute. In 1980, when before deregulation took hold, before, you know, Carter signed it and Reagan really just ramped it up, before they destroyed the regulations, there were about 16,000 trucking companies in the country. And there were no independent contractors. They were all employees, and a good number of them were covered under the Teamsters National Master Freight Agreement, which meant that everyone had you know, a good standard of wage, decent health care, defined benefit pension, decent working conditions, or at least negotiable working conditions. Now you've got 3.5 million of these drivers working for 1.5 million companies, which means that, you know, Joe bought a truck and he's Joe's Trucking. And the vast majority of these people work for companies like this, this New Prime, where, you know, they're really employees of the company, but they've just taken on all of the burdens. The burden of the vehicle, the burden of the maintenance, the vehicle of the insurance, the vehicle of the tolls and the fuel. And you go down the list of all of the headaches that corporations are going, you know, we don't want to deal with it. We just want to make the profit. We don't want to do all of that other stuff. We just want to make the profit. We'll saddle all that on the guy who can least shoulder it, the truck driver. And this isn't, this decision for me isn't just about truck drivers. I mean, it's the future of work in this country, because what's happening is everything is moving towards this independent contractor model. You're your own boss. You're your own boss, but we're going to tell you what to do, when to do, how to do, and all of that. So to me, this is a pretty big decision. And the fact that Gorsuch and Mr. I Like Beer came along with Alito, especially because the Teamsters were attached to this. Because as you've heard on this program numerous times, you know, we talk to port drivers all across the country, on the West Coast and the East Coast, about how they're being misclassified and screwed over. You know, we were down in Savannah a couple of years ago for one of our tours and met a guy who showed me a paycheck for like $3 for 60 hours of work. After they had taken out all of his costs and all of his fuel and all, I guess they fined him for using the wrong chassis or some nonsense. And you just go, you know, this is nuts. And you go, well, why does anyone do it? Well, they get stuck into it. You know, they hire you and you're going to have a job and you're going to make, you know, $70,000 a year. And you go, hey, you know, I'm going to take this training. And, you know, in this case, the guy had to give up the first 10,000 miles for free. And then it was like 30,000 more miles he had to complete at like $4 a day or some nonsense before he actually became a truck driver. And it's just remarkable the amount of stuff that goes on that we put up with just so that we can feed our families. And like I said, we're going to talk more about this in the coming days, because I think this is a pretty big decision. But, you know, again, you know, it's one of these, I'm literally shocked by it. So a lot of that. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with our good friend Adam Parkamenko about day 26 of the shutdown, how things are faring there in the nation's capital. Quick break. Right back with Adam. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. American, then workers standing up, and the union gives a voice to win. On the Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1865. That was the day General William T. Sherman issued Field Order No. 15. The order sought to redistribute 400,000 acres of land to freed blacks in 40-acre tracts. The area stretched from Charleston, South Carolina to Jacksonville, Florida, from the Atlantic Ocean to 30 miles inland. It also included many coastal islands, as well as Georgia's Sea Islands. Coming on the heels of Sherman's march to the sea, the order was issued from Savannah, Georgia. 4 days earlier, Sherman had met with 20 black ministers and the Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton. Sherman and Stanton asked the group a series of questions. How did they understand slavery, and what did freedom mean to them? When asked what the freedmen wanted most, Garrison Frazier, the group spokesman, replied land. And when asked whether they would prefer to live among whites or not, they replied no, as the prejudice of whites would take years to overcome. The order provided for the immediate settlement of black refugees on confiscated land. Land redistribution to former slaves was radical policy to break the economic power of the Confederacy, punish South Carolina for starting the war, and begin to consolidate a new class of agricultural laborers. The land titles were possessory, however, and contingent upon the Freedmen's Bureau to award permanent titles. President Andrew Johnson moved quickly in the wake of Lincoln's assassination to overturn Field Order No. 15. Within a year, it would be reversed and confiscated lands would be returned to newly pardoned Confederates and plantation owners. The overturning of the order and later of Reconstruction would lay the basis for a new type of slavery, that of sharecropping, debt peonage, and contract labor. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Your proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. You know, and going real quick, going back to what I was talking about in the last segment about this Supreme Court decision, unanimous. I literally could not imagine a unanimous decision coming out of this court. But what they pointed out is, this article pointed out, is that unionized drivers like UPS's 250,000 truck drivers who have a contract, they are classified as employees, they are paid as employees, and they are not subjected to mandatory arbitration clauses. They cannot be forced into, because they got a contract. And this is another one of those reasons why you join and form unions. This is another reason why you need that protection, just throwing that out there. So here we are, day 26 of the Trump-McConnell shutdown. And here to share some thoughts on why, how, what, where, all of that, I've asked our good friend Adam Parkamenko to come talk with us. Adam, thanks for taking time.
Thanks for having me.
So day 26, we surprised it's gone this long?
I don't think that there's anything surprising anymore with Donald Trump. But, you know, I think it's definitely one of these things where a couple weeks ago, you know, people thought, you know, 2 weeks in, everything would be open back up, and couldn't have predicted where we're at today. So I think anyone that seems to be able to predict how this is going to end probably, you know, has no idea what they're talking about.
Well, my prediction, again, you know, we can, everyone has an opinion, was I don't know that it ever reopens. The plan by Republicans for decades has been destroy government, tear it down, do what you got. And now you've got a guy who's all willing. He's like a little man baby with a giant hammer in a glass shop.
Yeah, I think that actually one of the best questions that anyone had posed early on with this whole thing was 3 weeks into December, where Stephen Colbert, you know, said, is anyone actually surprised that Donald Trump is shutting down the government he works against?
No, and the same thing with McConnell. I mean, all of them. There is no shock here. So the question is how do you move beyond that? How do you put pressure on the rest of the Republicans to find some conscience?
Well, I think that when it comes to McConnell, I think that one of the big issues he has right now is he's looking at this with kind of two different ways, and that's why he's pretty much been off the radar the whole time. One, you know, if he comes out and he pulls together a vote and has sort of this veto-proof bill that goes through and Donald Trump is forced to sign, then he's got a major problem in 2020 for his own reelection. There'll be a, you know, most people never thought that Bevin was going to come from where he was and end up becoming the governor down there. So all sorts of things could happen when Trump gets involved. And then the other piece of it is, you know, at the same time, he's being forced to sort of make a move here sooner or later, because the math is not in their favor in 2020. And, you know, you're already starting to see some erosion with some of these Republicans. So at some point here, you would think something has got to move. But, to date, it looks like McConnell's going on the side of, you know, not having any issues on his reelection and being in the minority, as opposed to, you know, not being able to be part of the Senate because he doesn't get elected at all again.
So, you know, and I look at this and I have a bunch of people going, well, you know, why? Is it really about the wall? Because I don't think it has anything to do with the wall. I think this has to do with a whole bunch of other things. One, the grand prize being, you know, just causing chaos and harming government, but also, you know, as a way of distracting from the Mueller probe, as a way of throwing a temper tantrum over the November elections. I mean, there's an awful lot to unpack here.
No, that's right. The more that we're talking about Donald Trump and the wall and, you know, the government shutdown, the less that we're talking about everything else with his investigation. But at the same time, it is Trump seems to never figure out a government shutdown doesn't affect the funding first team. It doesn't affect the work that they're doing. They keep going and doing what they're doing. To almost to some extent, it actually makes their jobs easier because he's just going crazy and, you know, creating all these problems, and they're doing what they've been doing all along. But I think that, you know, it's pretty insane. I mean, I said earlier today, and I still believe this, that Donald Trump is taking hostages and doesn't care whether they live or die. I mean, you've got 800,000 people who, it's not just those 800,000 people, it's their families, it's others that are affected, it's the entire economy. And people are having serious, serious problems right now, and they're getting, you know, kicked on the street or not being able to, you know, afford, you know, insulin and other things like that.
Well, I mean, this is a good, capitalist. There's a good capitalist solution here. Just open up a payday loan out of the White House.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I'm shocked, and I know we all shouldn't be shocked. And this is sort of kind of the next chapter and what everything that we've been expecting. But I think the one nice thing we always say is, you know, voting and elections have ramifications. And I'm just, you know, thank God every single day here that we took back the House and Nancy Pelosi's speaker. And some of these things she's doing are, you know, they're not just brilliant, but they're creative. And others are, you know, along the same lines, but they're just using great tactics and really knowing the rules of the position that she has. And I think to wake up and see the news of the State of the Union today, that is, you know, something that maybe, you know, people that are typically involved in Congress after Congress could have predicted. And I think it's probably not even something that Donald Trump knew she had the authority to do.
Yeah, no State of the Union for you.
You know, it's great. And it's for someone who, and I'm referring to Donald Trump, is so, you know, wants to avoid being humiliated at all costs and loves to and enjoys seeing other people humiliated. It's incredible the number of times she's just, as I kind of say, taken, you know, his lunch and eaten it in front of him. And he continues to carry through this thing. And it's all about, you know, this fake promise that was made during the campaign that is totally unnecessary and not needed.
Yeah, and what's interesting to me is you go back to you know, 2016, and that there was this populist mentality that, you know, he was going to care about, you know, the downtrodden, he was going to care about, you know, the poor working stiff, and yet you look at all the things that he's done that are harming the very people who voted for him.
Yeah, and the question is you know, what happens between now and 2020, and you know, does he survive his presidency in terms of being able to run for re-election? He's still sitting president, able to run for re-election, and then what happens with those folks who were with him the first time? But I think given what we saw in 2018, and given the numbers that we're seeing right now, he has no exit strategy. He had no strategy going into this, and I just have absolutely no idea, you know, what his plan is to get out, but He appears to be, you know, far more damaged even earlier without the outcome of the Mueller investigation even existing yet.
Yeah, and the thing is I've been saying this, you know, all week, that, you know, Lindsey Graham gave him the out. He had the perfect out. Lindsey Graham teed it up for him, and, well, he duffed it.
Yeah, and Lindsey Graham, I mean, I think that everyone needs to kind of stand strong here, and I feel very strongly that there shouldn't be any bills or business going on in the U.S. Senate until they reopen government. But, you know, Lindsey Graham is who he's always been. It's just, you know, previous years we sort of looked past it and thought he was kind of one of these bipartisan people that worked well with people because he had some Democrats that were friends and he aligned himself with John McCain. But at the end of the day, he's never been that person, and it's really just pulling back the curtain on who he's always been.
Yeah, I mean, I look at this, and look, I've never been a fan of Lindsey Graham, but you're right. He's always been this way, but always positioned himself. And I guess now, did you watch the hearing the other day?
Yeah.
I got a kick out of the, I forgot how he phrased it, but something along the lines of, you know, he doesn't like the other Lindsay either. And I'm going, what right. the hell does that mean?
Yeah, I mean, and he made that other comment too, where he you know, said to Barr, okay, so do you think that Donald Trump, you know, likes things condensed in one pages? Just remember that, okay? I guess he's referring to, you know, trimming down the Mueller report and making it into, you know, one page of information that, you know, is omitting all of the important and critical parts of this investigation. But he's just a totally odd dude. And, I mean, really kind of the worst of the worst when it comes to these political hacks.
Now, I keep wondering, you know, how it is he keeps getting elected. But I kept saying the same thing about Jeff Sessions. I have no idea how it is those guys go before voters in those states and they go, yep, that's the guy we want.
Right. Well, and, you know, one thing that I like to point out is, I think it was either November or December of 2016, Lindsey Graham came out. I think CNN was the one that broke it. But the headline was, Lindsey Graham announces that he was hacked in the 2016 presidential campaign. And that was sort of the last we ever heard of it. But you have to wonder, you know, whatever came of that. And a lot of these things that people say nowadays, you know, whether it's about Donald Trump or Lindsey Graham, you say, oh, you know, Donald Trump seems to be working for Russia, or, you know, he seems to be. And then news comes out that, you know, the FBI opened up a counterintelligence investigation against Donald Trump. There's a huge difference, as we've talked about a bunch of different times, between conspiracy theories and criminal conspiracies. And the number of criminal conspiracies that exist that are being investigated and appear to be real, that the right just thinks and wants everyone to believe are conspiracy theories, are endless. But it seems a lot of these things that we've suspected about Donald Trump that are appearing to be true are similar when it comes to Lindsey Graham. There's just, you know, there's been these reports over the last couple of years that have never had additional information that have come out.
Yeah, I mean, and one of the things that I took from that hearing with the guy who's going to be Attorney General, Mr. Barr, the fact that he said Mueller wouldn't be part of a witch hunt made me go immediately that, well, I guess you're going to be in the Trump doghouse. I'm waiting for the attacks to start against this guy because, you know, how do you have your guy say, you know, Mueller wouldn't be part of a witch hunt while you're screaming witch hunt and hoax? I'm waiting for the angry tweets at Barr to begin.
Right. Well, and you know, I think that's sort of the point that everyone was making afterwards, which is there's really no scenario where he wouldn't have to recuse himself, not only because the civil servant, you know, ethics attorneys over there would come out and basically say that he needs to, and the amount of public pressure would force him to. But the other thing that I thought was really almost comical was what Wolf Blitzer pointed out, which is, you know, Trump has made for a year and a half these accusations that Comey and Mueller are best friends, and suggested, you know, there's 100 photos of them, and Jason Leopold at BuzzFeed just did a FOIA of FBI. It came back with 0 photos of Comey and Mueller from the FBI. And then Wolf points out and says, but what we do know from our research is actually that Barr and Mueller are very close friends. So you've got, you know, Trump saying that Comey and Mueller, you know, Mueller's conflicted because he's so close with Comey, when in reality the person that you could suggest is conflicted with Mueller is Barr. People aren't suggesting that. However, that's just Donald Trump's argument and the facts.
Yeah, it's just as we're in this really weird world. And, you know, I have some conservative friends that I talk to who, you know, they've bought the hoax thing. You know, because and tell me if you think this is ridiculous. This is how they see collusion. It's their view, unless Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin were sitting down in a room together with smoke in the back room and a table, you know, where they were hatching a plan together to steal the presidency. Anything short of that is not collusion.
Right. And they move the goalpost, you know, not just every single day, but, you know, by the hour and. Even in the course of your show tonight, I think Rudy made some news with Chris Cuomo basically saying some crazy stuff on Russia and doing the same thing again. But it's just not the case. And I think that we've all seen that they're getting far more closer to piecing all this together, most of which came with the new Manafort polling news for what he had been sending over to Deripaska. And I think that, it's pretty clear that all the pieces fall in place, but this is all still very little that we know compared to everything that Mueller knows. So it will be very fascinating. That's why it's so critical to make sure that we can all see this report.
Yeah, and that's the important thing, that we get to see it, and that it gets to be done, and we get to see it. But I keep coming back to, what's taking so damn long?
Right.
Our country is crumbling. I mean, we are in real chaos. The fact that our government is shut down, hundreds of thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of families are struggling and suffering, and there's no end to this in sight. You go, please hurry.
It's sort of that catch-22, right, which is in terms of nothing compares to this, but in terms of investigations in the past, whether they truly were kind of these actual witch hunts as opposed to this, they went on for years and years and years, and this one has been going on for 2 years and has netted the government money. However, we'd all love it, love to see it come to an end and have a resolution here, given what we're currently dealing with. So I think everything has a way of working itself out. I never thought we'd be in the position that we're in today during the 2016 election. But given what happened, I'm glad that with each sort of piece of news that comes out or each indictment, it seems like they've really left no stone unturned.
Yeah, I hope so. And like I said, I hope we get to see all of this because, the right-wing spin machine is working overtime. In fact, I had someone the other night tell me that, I guess he heard it on fake news that what's going on is a coup attempt. The Democrats are attempting a coup, and I'm going, do you even know what the definition of coup is?
It's like Steve Scalise coming out today, inviting the president to the House to do his State of the Union, that he'll find a place for him to speak. It kind of goes back to the Donald Trump talking point in January of 2017 when he was basically saying that, people couldn't accept the outcome of the last election. Well, things have certainly changed in a number of ways on the House side, but also I don't think that Democrats should just say, we're Democrats and we're going to, we always do things, the perfect way. We should do things the perfect way, but also we should play the same game that they played with them that they played with us when we were in the minority. And we should act like people who are in the majority and push back on all this stuff and own being in the majority. And I think that that's really critical. And I think that we're seeing that it's on full display with Nancy Pelosi reminding Donald Trump that, she's his equal.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting couple of days, hopefully not a couple of months. This is just crazy. Last question I've got for you, coming back to this shutdown. Obviously D.C.'s being hit hardest by it because, there's so many people who work for the federal government. What are you seeing as you're looking around the city, as you're mulling about?
I picked up my son today and we had to run over to the post office to renew his passport. And when I got home, there were two women that were walking outside of my neighborhood. And one of them, she wasn't crying, but she sounded like she was crying, and she sounded just desperate and devastated when she was talking to her friend, but in a way where she was screaming, talking about how she was going into work tomorrow and she can't do this anymore. And, it's really remarkable. You see it sort of everywhere you go. I mean, there's been a number of people who, families that on a weekly basis for years and years and years have provided to food banks that, their family would pick up stuff and give it to them. And now those same families are in line at the same food banks they've been giving to for years and years. It's really incredibly sad, and I think there's going to be a lot more irreversible damage from this, and it's getting worse with each passing day. And I think a lot of this still, I wish I could be someone to help organize it, but I wish at the very least that, BWI, Dulles, and National, that TSA workers in those three airports would just not show up. And I think that would be incredibly damaging, not just to Republican senators who wouldn't be able to fly out, but also I think it would shut everything down, just those three airports alone.
Yeah, I think it's got to be more than just TSA. I think it's got to be everybody, because the second you single out TSA, I already believe, and I said this the other night, as soon as if our government ever does open back up, You're going to hear calls to reprivatize TSA immediately if you haven't already heard it happening. And I think if you were to go and do that and strike like that, it would give Trump the opportunity to fire all of them and then privatize. I'm a huge fan of general strikes. Huge fan.
Yeah.
I think it's got to be more than just the TSA workers.
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, I'd love to see just those three airports all together, everyone not show up, you know?
Yeah.
Whether that's the pilots and flight attendants and, you know, air traffic controllers and you name it. But something's got to happen. And I think that's one of the easiest ways to really shut stuff down.
Yeah, I'm with you. Adam, I appreciate the time. I look forward to talking to you again. Thanks so much for sharing some thoughts.
You too. Thanks, my friend.
Good stuff, Adam Parkamenko. Check out his website, adamparkamenko.com. We'll get links out so you can check out some of his writings. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1946. That was the day the United Packing House Workers of America went on strike. Their initial demand was for a 25-cent-an-hour raise. They were also joined in the strike by the Amalgamated Meat Cutters Union. The action was part of a massive wave of walkouts after World War II that included steel and auto workers. Frustrated that wartime profits had not benefited working people, unions across multiple industries were on the march. According to historian Roger Horowitz, the United Packing House Workers of America's strike was supported by an overwhelming membership vote of 20-1. For 3 months before the strike, the membership prepared. The strike was planned with the strategy of strong local rank-and-file organizing. Membership was encouraged to participate in mass pickets, as well as in building community support for the action. This grassroots organizing proved a successful tactic. The strike cut meat production across the country by 50%. The Brooklyn Daily Eagle headline declared, "Rush on meat as strike cuts supply." The newspaper described how 300 women had stormed one marketplace to purchase meat before it ran out. Alarmed by the consumer shortages, President Harry S. Truman stepped in. On the 10th day of the strike, by the authority of the War Labor Disputes Act, he ordered the workers back to their jobs. President Truman ordered a commission to study their demands. In the end, the commission awarded the workers a 16-cent-an-hour raise. Although it fell short of the quarter-an-hour demand, it was the largest increase ever won in the industry. It was also the first successful strike by the meatpacking workers. The workers had shown how local solidarity could demonstrate the power of labor. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Minimum wage!
Yeah! You know what it means when they pay you minimum wage? You know what they're trying to tell you? It's like, hey, if I could pay you less, I would.
Well, get ready for all of the doomsday scenarios. The sky is falling, the end of the world. If they raise the minimum wage, all jobs will be gone. There'll be no more employment. Everyone will be fired. There'll be no more jobs because the wages are too high. And the other one, you know, automation. They'll automate everything. Well, let me let you in a little secret. They're going to automate anyway. So while we still have a job, you should at least make a reasonable wage, just my thought. Anyway, today, House Democrats unveiled the Raise the Wage Act, and here to share some thoughts on that, I've asked our good friend Mark Price. He's a labor economist with the Keystone Research Center, also working with the group here in PA, Raise the Wage PA, to raise our minimum wage as well. Mark, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, it's always wonderful to be here.
So the sky's going to fall, Mark. A hamburger is going to be $75,000 a piece, and we won't have a giant buffet of fast food like we had the other day for the Clemson players.
These will be terrible times. You know, you, of course, are being funny, but I was just on the radio, a different radio, not as good a radio program as this, the other day with the Chamber's spokesman, and he literally made this argument that, oh my goodness, they raised the minimum wage to $15 in New York City, and you can't get a cup of coffee anywhere.
Nowhere? No coffee?
No coffee, man. It's you know, it sort of boggles the mind that these people can make these arguments in an open forum, but they make them. You know, of course, the reality is that you can get a cup of coffee in California and Seattle in New York City, just as you can anywhere else in the country. You often hear these sort of strange arguments about raising the minimum wage. And thankfully, a large number of folks in the U.S. House and the Senate have signed on to the Raise the Wage Act, which will raise, hopefully, the wage in the whole country to 15 by 2024.
I'll tell you, you know, my first thought is look, as I said at the beginning, you know, back in 2012 when we were first talking about this, as this was beginning to take root, you know, people were saying, well, 15 is completely outrageous. I'm going, no, you know, what happened to that reward for work thing that when you work, your life should get better? And, you know, even if you're working a minimum wage job, it should be something that you can exist on. I don't know how you exist on 7.25, and I don't know how you'd exist on 15.
Yeah, and, you know, that same chamber spokesman sort of acknowledged you can't exist on 7.25. Or if you are, you're you know, couch surfing with friends, you're relying on the local food bank. It's just certainly not enough. And the fact that we've kept that entry-level wage as low as 7.25 for as long as we have is sort of put a little bit of extra weight and kept wages lower for workers that are earning a little bit more than 7.25, all the way up to 15. We've seen less growth in hourly wages here in Pennsylvania than in every other state that has managed to raise the minimum wage. And, you know, that's money that's not in our pockets here in Pennsylvania, which is terrible and certainly something we should reverse.
Yeah, you know, because I remember the arguments, you know, of when other states would raise their minimum wage. They go, oh, we can steal jobs from them because, you know, their wages are higher. And yet I'm not seeing all of the jobs fleeing into Pennsylvania from other states.
Right. You know, and again, you will often hear, you know, you raise the wage in Pennsylvania and all the pizza companies are going to go to New Jersey. And, of course, you know, New Jersey raised its minimum wage, as did New York, as did every neighboring state. And lo and behold, it's not the case that all the pizza places in the region are located now in Pennsylvania because our wages are lower. In fact, when you look at food services as a whole, an industry that uses a disproportionate share of low-wage workers, folks who would be impacted by a minimum wage increase, in every one of those states, you have seen faster growth in that sector than you have seen here in Pennsylvania, even though we've kept our wage low. It's sort of an odd sort of thing to have stick out for these folks when they've been arguing so strenuously that, you know, as you said, you know, the world will come to an end if we raise the wage.
Yeah, the dogs and the cats will sleep together.
My favorite line.
The other thing that I think is important about this is because, you know, I'll tell you, I like organizing. I like, you know, people getting active and engaged in things. But, you know, I'm kind of tired of fighting for minimum wage increases. There should have been an index. There should have been a way to make sure that it doesn't get eroded by a decade of inflation. You know, maybe we could solve that problem. And this Raise the Wage Act actually has some indexing in it, right?
Absolutely. And not just your average everyday indexing. Typically, I know it's exciting. It's an innovation in policymaking, which is, you know, makes me excited, but, you know, I'm kind of a geek. 18 states across the country already have indexing. So New Jersey and Ohio are two examples. The indexing there uses the consumer price index, which is a not unreasonable approach. You know, basic idea as the average price level sort of weight up, you know, the increase in the price of milk and gasoline and what those represent in a family's budget. As those prices rise, you get a few cents a year increase in the minimum wage. The Raise the Wage Act, instead of using the consumer price index, is proposing using the growth in median wages. And, you know, your listeners hopefully are not falling asleep on us as I'm describing that. The reason that's important is really what we're talking about when we're talking about raising the entry-level wage, the minimum wage, is we want to keep it near where sort of middle-class workers are. So back in 1968, it was roughly half the minimum wage at $1.60 an hour. That was half of the median wage for a full-time, full-year worker at $3.15. And today, the minimum wage at $7.25 is less than a third of the wage that a middle-class worker earns. And so by the Raise the Wage Act, if it eventually passes, including this indexing to the median wage, we're doing a better job than if we were just using the Consumer Price Index of making sure that we're not making people poorer, right? That we're, because when wages grow slower, especially for people who are sort of just a little bit outside the middle class, it's harder to afford things like rent and food. So when you're indexing appropriately, as this is suggesting, you'll see less stress on those households going forward, which is a good thing.
Yeah, that's a good thing. So does $15 an hour by 2024, does that put us near that 50% number? Where does it put us on that scale?
In Pennsylvania, that gets us to just about 53% of where we think median wages will be. I mean, obviously, you have to project out in the future, but based on growth and what we think of in terms of wage growth going forward, we'll basically get just a little bit past where we were in 1968, which is a great thing.
No, I mean, at the end of the day, Republicans love to demand work. They just don't want to pay for it. I mean, I look at the shutdown that's going on right now. They love making people work. They just don't want to pay them. And this is one of those things where I go, at the end of the day, every job I've ever had made my life a little bit better. I went to work, I got a paycheck, and I was able to make it to the next week. Sadly, there are so many people who go to work and at the end of the week go, I still can't make it till tomorrow.
Yeah. And, when you often hear the arguments these folks will make, they talk about these, mandates that you're putting on employers, these terrible burdensome mandates. And no one ever asked the question, if you've got a business model that can't possibly succeed and be profitable without pushing people into poverty, maybe you don't have a God-given American right to run a business, right? Maybe part of the problem is that your business plan sucks, that you're not good as an entrepreneur. And typically, these kind of folks are the ones advocating for creative destruction in the larger economy. And I think when you look across the state, one of the things that's beginning to emerge from some of the research is that, in fact, yes, when you raise wages, it does drive some employers out, but it also brings new employers into a sector. So it creates a bit of innovation. In the same way, then in the long run, it's probably going to emphasize, as you talked about, some degree of automation, which is actually a good thing. There will always be low-wage jobs in the economy. We have a responsibility of making sure that the low-wage jobs that exist, wherever they exist, pay a living wage.
Yeah, but I was going to bring up automation because, I'm sure you've seen the report, as many of us have, that within, the next 15, 20 years, half of all jobs across the globe will be automated. And, one of the big arguments is, they're going to automate and you'll get nothing. And that's probably true, which is why I think we need to have a much better tax code to make sure that we reap some of the benefits of technology.
Absolutely. I think a lot of people forget there was a lot of automation. There was a lot of industrial development that went on from the 1945 to around 1973, and yet that was a period when we had pretty good, actually very good, especially relative to our current pattern of growth in wages. We had very strong growth in middle-class wages, wages at the bottom. In fact, so much so that they grew as fast as wages at the top. And that's an era with a lot of innovation. So I think it's important to remember that we're always going to have capital. We're always going to have robots. They're going to be here. It's just important to keep the distribution of income and make sure that the jobs that exist are paying good wages. If it ever does come to it that the robots put us all out of business, well, then, we'll have to band together and come up with a new way of making a living. But I think, I'm in that group of economists that certainly would acknowledge that automation is important, that, the robots are coming. But, it's not the apocalypse, at least yet. And even if it does achieve apocalyptic proportions, You know, we're human beings. We'll get together. We'll figure out a way to make it work.
Well, that's the hope anyway. And look, I'm not a Luddite, but, you know, I don't want my neighbor to lose their job because a machine came in and took their job and just kind of where I'm at.
Yeah, no, and I think that's perfectly reasonable. And, you know, it's one of those trade-offs that we haven't done a good job when you think about sort of trade, right, international trade. We all like goods and services made, you know, wherever they're made. But it often does create these problems in the economy where people lose their jobs because we've now engaged in trade. And I think the same impacts happen with technology, and we just have to take sort of a joint responsibility that when people do get hurt, that we take care of them, that we make sure that they transition, if they can, to a good job. But if they can't, then they need to have an expectation that they're going to get a reasonable income. You know, these are not hard things to do, they shouldn't be, but politically sometimes they can be hard because, again, it's often these very rich people who, you know, point fingers and, you know, accuse other people who actually work of being lazy, right? And I think, you know, in the end, automation like trade can be good for us. We just have to take control of the economy and make sure that we demand that, you know, everybody's okay after we engage in these kinds of deals, whether it's trade or automation.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I've talked about, you know, all along through this Fight for 15 movement is, you know, the other part of 15. It's, you know, Fight for 15 and a union part. That, because you talked about, you know, end of World War II to 1973, you had strong growth, wages kept going up. And I would argue a big part of that was the ability to demand better wages, hours, and conditions, because we had much higher union density. As things continue to fall, and we're almost at a point in the private sector where, you know, union density is about the same as it was when it was illegal. So, yeah. You know, the ability to fight for those better wages, hours, and conditions is being hampered. And while I am all in favor of legislation like this to, you know, to prop up the bottom, we need to have something also to make sure that there's a voice for those folks and for everybody up the scale as well.
I think that's absolutely correct. And really, if you look, I think, at this era, one thing that's quite clear is that when we lost union bargaining power, that also lines up pretty closely with the fact that we were much more rarely got minimum wage increases, and when we got them, they were quite small. So that really, as union power has weakened, our ability even to raise the minimum wage has weakened, right? And that the two things are related and actually, you know, quite important. So to the extent that we're able to get the minimum wage higher, I think you're absolutely correct. Our ability to sustain that, right? Our ability, for instance, to get an inflation adjustment really is a function of we need more bargaining power in a larger economy. So I think if our best dreams come true, that we do actually get something like a $15 minimum wage with an inflation adjustment, that's only going to be possible if we begin to see a regrowth of bargaining power, right? So, you know, looking out of the West Coast and those teachers on strike in L.A., we need to see more of that. We need to see people taking back opportunity.
I'm right there with you.
No,
absolutely. Last question I've got for you, because I got to ask, economist and all of that, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, on a kind of throwaway comment, alluded to a 70% top marginal tax rate. Where are we on that?
We are absolutely in favor of that. I think, you know, you talked in the past about why not have a maximum wage, and I don't especially have a problem with the maximum wage, but, you know, I'm happy to have a top marginal tax rate. Again, if you were at above a certain threshold, say over $1 million, you're going to pay a tax rate of that every dollar above a million of 7%. You know, some might go as high as 80, maybe 90. I think that's absolutely a wonderful idea. Again, because the danger, and we've seen the danger in the economy the last 40 years, is that when you allow the rich to get that much richer, they take political power and they hurt us all. They slow the growth in wages, not only for the middle, but folks at the bottom. So it's very important to restrain that power by doing things like having very high tax rates. So, you know, it's an amazing thing, Rick. You know, these kind of discussions about returning to those eras of high top marginal tax rate was very hard to find, you know, a decade ago. And you've been doing this for so long. It's you, of course, talking about these things. But, you know, in the broader society, I think this probably the first time in my memory that I've seen a real mature conversation about, you know, 70% marginal top marginal tax rate. It's it made me very happy to see that take off and see the right just go completely bonkers. Yeah. So it's a good sign.
No, absolutely. Good stuff. Mark, as always, I appreciate the time. I look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Oh, thank you. It's always a great pleasure.
Good stuff. One of my favorite people, Mark Price. Check out his stuff. You can follow him on Twitter. We'll make sure we get things out. You can do that. Really, really good stuff. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. And listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
From UN headquarters in New York, I'm Luke Vargas with your World in 2 Minutes. Desalination, the process through which salt water is converted into usable fresh water, is rapidly rising to address the challenge of global water shortages and has already rendered chronically dry corners of the world habitable. There are nearly 16,000 desalination plants around the world, with the highest concentration in the Middle East and North Africa. Those plants often treat seawater and tend to be larger and less efficient than those in North America that mostly treat rivers and estuaries. And new research this week suggests that super salty brine discharged at desalination plants bordering the world's oceans is now causing problems of its own.
The salinity is potentially a big problem, especially in not very well flushed areas.
Edward Jones is an environmental scientist and researcher at Wageningen University in the Netherlands.
If we're dumping lots of brine into the ocean whereby there's not much circulation, this can cause saline underflows within the ocean. And this can reduce the dissolved oxygen content, and this is the reason why there can be associated effects with the ecology. Organisms that live on the seafloor can suffer from this lack of oxygen in conditions we call hypoxia.
By one estimate, desalination plants produce 1.5 liters of brine for each liter of fresh water, and with an estimated 95 million cubic meters of desalinated water now produced each day, that's a lot of brine. Worse still are plants that use toxic chemicals like chloride or copper in the desalination process.
These are the toxic elements that can potentially accumulate in the environment and cause negative effects for marine life.
But there are fixes on the horizon. By mixing brine with wastewater or power plant cooling water, the resulting discharge can be less salty and harmful to the environment. Brine can also be converted into lye and other industrial gases. But until those processes become less expensive, a variant of the old adage will remain true. There's no such thing as a free drink. Luke Vargas, the United Nations.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. The Rick Smith Show.
I'll tell you, I love it when economists, you know, get all fired up about something. Mark's one of the really great guys in the economics world, and he's on the right side of things. And I think the economics profession is coming around to it. I remember when I was in high school and in college, they were, you know, labor unions were bad. They take from profit and you know we could use that profit to, you know, and then they would, you know, go into this whole, you know, philosophical debate of, you know, what they could do with all that profit, like reinvest in new machinery and new products and research and development and all this stuff. Only now we've now learned from that time forward till now that when these big corporations, when they make that kind of money, when they get to keep all the profit, they don't have to share with their workers. They don't invest in new plants and new machinery. They don't invest in research and development. They pocket it, and then they buy politicians so that they don't have to pay tax on it. It's really, you know, well, predictable. If you give somebody a whole bunch of money, they're going to want to keep all of it. And I love the simple-minded rhetoric that you see coming out of the right. You know, Scott Walker's response to Cortez's, ideas, saying that, you know, if grandma gives you $10, the government's going to take $7 of it. And you go, no, dimwit, unless grandma gave you $10 million along with that $10, then yeah, after that, $7. And I think there's not a problem with that. But it's that simple-minded kind of rhetoric that really gets us, you know, mired in these idiotic discussions of, and the wealthy, very happy that we do this to ourselves, that we allow ourselves to be divided and conquered. Very, very bizarre stuff. Just amazing. Anyway, going to take a quick break. When we come back, John Fetterman going to be here. Now the lieutenant.